You are listening to a sermon by Janice Kreider, recorded on Sunday, September 1st, 2013, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
When I was growing up on the farm in Ohio, my sister and I were intrigued with water. We had a horse tank, but the water in there was all scummy and dark. So we decided to build our own little pool. We dug a hole and poured in the water. But even the heavy clay soil didn't prevent the water from soaking down. But I had an idea. I found a piece of wood, and I asked my dad to cut it so that it would fit at the bottom of this small hole. Again, we poured in water, but did it hold water? Perhaps that is why I was intrigued by Jeremiah 2:13 out of all the verses in today's lectionary. My people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living water, and dug out cisterns for themselves, cracked cisterns that can hold no water. This verse is a little poem or a mini parable, and it uses a different metaphor than in the other verses of Jeremiah, around, I think, maybe chapter 3, which use the marriage metaphor. And we've already heard a lot about the marriage metaphor in sermons, and we heard about it recently from Andre, the book of Hosea, and I thought it's time for a different metaphor. So regarding the cisterns in the Old Testament world of Israel, they were exposed rock outcrops in the valley bottoms that retained some of the flood water after the torrents had disappeared. And these cisterns would develop cracks that the locals would try to fill with plaster or rocks. The water would be flat and tasteless in them, and easily contaminated with various types of growth that produce a smelly scum. This water is in contrast to the water that comes from springs. Rainfall in the Lebanese mountains would saturate the layers of the mountains until reaching the layers of carbon, and once the carbon layer is reached, the water is forced horizontally, and springs burst forth from the side of the mountains and flow down to the valleys. This, of course, required rainy seasons, and they were considered as gifts of God. The rain is still, or the region is still rain-dependent today, and water is scarce. And I heard on the news this past week that water supply is a huge issue for the Syrian refugees in Jordan. Cisterns were common in those days, and in the Old Testament, even earlier. But they were often empty. And you remember the story of Joseph, whose brothers threw him into a pit with no water in it? But that was probably a cistern. A similar thing happened to Jeremiah when King Zedekiah didn't like his predictions. And I'm going to read a little bit about that in Jeremiah 38. An Ethiopian eunuch took compassion on Jeremiah. Basically, it's a kind of hospitality that this Ethiopian eunuch did. And he persuaded the king that to free Jeremiah from this cistern. And starting in verse 11, I like the very careful way he did it. So Abed-Melech, which is the Ethiopian eunuch's name, so Abed-Melech took three men with him and went to the house of the king to a wardrobe of the storehouse and took from there old rags and worn-out clothes, which he let down to Jeremiah in the cistern by ropes. Then Abed-Melech the Ethiopian said to Jeremiah, "Just put the rags and clothes between your armpits and the ropes." Jeremiah did so. Then they drew Jeremiah up by the ropes and pulled him out of the cistern, and Jeremiah remained in the court of the guard. He was still under house arrest, but at least he wasn't in that scratchy and murky cistern. If you think cisterns are not relevant to our area of British Columbia, well, I'd like to read from Des Kennedy's book, The Way of a Gardener. You may remember him. He used to do a lot of broadcasting and writing and so on. He came from a poor family, so he and his brother trained to be priests, but he loved poetry and loved writing poetry, and that was the end of his going into the priesthood. And he lives on Salt Spring Island. He was involved in the anti-logging campaigns, too. He ended up losing his Christian faith as we probably know it, but I liked his last chapter, which he calls Redemption, and he tells a little bit about his spirituality there. So here he is trying to grow vegetables on Salt Spring Island. Our principal challenge was watering. We were totally unprepared for how quickly and completely the island went dry in summer, especially in a clear cut. After a few weeks of sunshine, the earth turned to a fine dust that coated every surface. Our little creek unexpectedly ran dry. Desperately, we hauled barrels of water from a nearby pond, while I hand dug a succession of ultimately unproductive shallow wells. On one of these, I installed a small pump attached to a bicycle, by which I planned to pump water uphill to the veggie patch. Although impeccably correct in principle long before its time, this scheme proved an abject failure. Eventually, we had a backhoe excavate a deep hole in a low-lying area, into which a slow but reliable pool of murky water seeped. From there, we pumped it to the garden using a cantankerous gas-fired pump, whose repeated malfunctions drove me close to madness. Such were our water woes that for several years I had recurring dreams of finding a splendid spring of fresh, clean water. Now on to the book of Jeremiah and what it's all about. Well, I'm not going to go into what it's all about, but it's a very interesting book. But first, let's go to Kitsilano and imagine a house there that was built 100 years ago. And a family lived there for 50 years. And the next owner turns it into a rooming house with flimsy walls and a few grotty washrooms. The next owner renovates it and turns it into four condos with large windows overlooking decks, a cathedral ceiling on the top floor, granite countertops, gas fireplaces, the works. Then you move into one of these sparkling condos. Is it possible to know what the original house was like? Maybe there's one original fireplace, a little pane of leaded glass, some original floors, and maybe an old neighbor will remember something. Well, this is what happened to the book of Jeremiah, in a way. It was first created prior to the people of Judah being sent off to Babylon. And the prophet Jeremiah is there with his predictions, and they end up being fulfilled. However, it was reworked or renovated several times during and after the exile. So it's impossible even for some scholars to ferret out the original. Yet, I would argue that it has a message for us and a meaning. A couple of years ago, Walter Brueggemann, a retired professor at the Columbia Theological Seminary in Georgia, came to Regent College and gave lectures on Jeremiah, and some of you were there. I was quite impressed by these lectures. So I went to Regent and the bookstore or the library and checked out a number of his books, and I'm using a lot of his ideas. He wrote one of his books is on Jeremiah 1 to 25, chapters 1 to 25. And he states that the book of Jeremiah is, and I'm quoting, an anguished poetic reflection and didactic prose explanation about the cause of Israel's end and the destiny of those deported to Babylon. The event of the exile was a big event in Israel's existence. But in the book of Jeremiah, it's not considered in a political way. There are a lot of politics around it, and you can see those in there. But the book considers the exile in light of covenantal realities, the covenantal realities of Yahweh's sovereignty and power. Brueggemann identifies three elements of this covenantal understanding of historical reality in the book of Jeremiah. The first one is Israel's covenant with Yahweh, rooted in the memories and mandates of the Sinai tradition. This is the story of their being slaves in Egypt and going through the desert, getting the Ten Commandments and all the other rules and the covenant and everything. The second is the pathos of Yahweh. Yahweh's willingness to move beyond the covenantal sanction and towards an articulation of hope. The covenant says, you know, I do this, you do that. The pathos of Yahweh, the love of God, the grace of God, the compassion of God, there's a willingness there to move beyond that covenant. And the third is a rejection of the royal temple ideology of Jerusalem. The thinking was that the temple apparatus, and apparatus is not my term, that's Brueggemann's term, the royal temple apparatus was immune to both the covenant sanctions and to God's judgment. Jeremiah points to a new covenant in Jeremiah 31, verses 31 and 2, and you may have this memorized. The days are surely coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant that I made with their ancestors, and it goes on to explain. Jeremiah 7, 2 to 11, describes both the disobedience to the Sinai tradition and the arrogance of the temple ideology. Starting at verse 2, stand in the gate of the Lord's house and proclaim there this word and say, hear the word of the Lord, all you people of Judah, you that enter these gates to worship the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and let me dwell with you in this place. Do not trust in these deceptive words. This is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. For if you truly amend your ways and your doings, if you truly act justly one with another, if you do not oppress the alien, the orphan, and the widow, or shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not go after other gods to your own hurt, then I will dwell with you in this place, in the land I gave of old to your ancestors forever and ever. Here you are, trusting in deceptive words to no avail. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, make offerings to Baal, and go after other gods that you have not known? And then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are safe, only to go on doing all these abominations? Has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your sight? You know, I too am watching. You heard something familiar there that Jesus said. Now for today's verse. My people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living water, and dug out cisterns for themselves, cracked cisterns that can hold no water. What does it mean, they have forsaken me? Well, we've just heard in the Jeremiah 7 passage some descriptions of that. Forsaking the teachings of the Torah. Widows and orphans are mentioned as they are in many other scriptures. I read a chapter called Jeremiah and the Poor by a South African theologian in which he notes that there are three Hebrew words for the poor. The first refers to peasants forced to work for the benefit of others and likely experiencing daily oppression. The second word refers to those who have a constant or an urgent deficiency, vulnerable people. And I would think here that those would be orphans, those unable to work, those who are suddenly very sick, whatever. The third word, used 80 times in the Hebrew canon, refers to people who experience both outward deprivation and inner humiliation. And this term links poverty and oppression, and I think abuse would fall into this term as well. By following the Torah and its instructions regarding the Sabbath and the poor, and we heard about that last Sunday from Veronica, And I like the phrase in one of the songs, those who labor without rest. Those laboring without rest means they have no Sabbath. But by following the Torah and its instructions regarding Sabbath and the poor, it would have been possible for the laboring peasants and caring landowners to have a sustainable society and community. But the tendency was for the elite to take as much as possible of the peasant surplus, leaving the peasants with just enough to survive, barely enough to procreate. Living off the land is difficult enough in a rain-challenged region, and there are limits as to what can be taken away from hard-working tillers of the land, as we well know from the history of our Mennonite people in Russia at the time of Stalin. My people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living water, and dug out cisterns for themselves, cracked cisterns that can hold no water. What does it mean, dug out cisterns for themselves, cracked cisterns that can hold no water? What are these cracked cisterns? Two earlier verses in the chapter give us clues. Jeremiah 2:5, they went far from me and went after worthless things and became worthless themselves. And Jeremiah 2:11, has a nation changed its gods, even though they are no gods? But my people have changed their glory for something that does not profit. With all the rewriting of Jeremiah, it's not clear whether the new gods are the indigenous fertility gods of the region or the gods of Babylon, probably both. Jeremiah 2:26 and 7 says, their kings, their officials, their priests, and their prophets say to a tree, you are my father, and to a stone, you gave me birth. Jeremiah 2:28, you have as many gods as you have towns, O Judah. Elmer Martins, in his Believer's Church commentary on Jeremiah, suggests that the cracked cisterns could also refer to reliance on Egypt and Assyria, nations to whom Israel went and depended on for help against the advice of Jeremiah. My people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living water, and dug out cisterns for themselves, cracked cisterns that can hold no water. Now it's time for a quiz. We haven't even started school yet, and I'm giving you a quiz. Where you fill in the blank. Well, these are questions that we have to answer for ourselves. The first one comes from the first part of the verse. In what ways may we have forsaken God, the fountain of living water? Are there teachings of God that we're not following because they're not to our advantage, or they seem preposterous, or they seem foolish? And the second question is from the second part of the verse. What cracked cisterns have we dug and are trying to maintain? What kind of substitutes, authorities, technology, or do-it-yourself schemes do we rely on for our safety, our economic security, and our spirituality? I'd like to close with a prayer written by Brueggemann. We're having a couple of those today. And it's based on Psalm 104. I would like to read a couple of verses from there, verses 10 to 13. You make springs gush in the valleys. They flow between the hills, giving drink to every wild animal. The wild asses quench their thirst. By the streams, the birds of the air have their habitation. They sing among the branches. From your lofty abode, you water the mountains. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of your work. Now, Brueggemann's prayer is entitled Water That Does Not Come Bottled, on reading Psalm 104. And it's from a book called Prayers for a Privileged People. Creator God, we celebrate you. You make springs gush forth in the valleys. They flow between the hills, giving drink to every wild animal. And wild asses quench their thirst. You send rain and water the earth. It springs to growth. We eat and are satisfied. We thank you and easily push back from the table. In our comfortable plenty, we notice drought here and famine there. The work of human hands. The lack seems remote from us, but in solidarity we register the loss and the fear and the death. We count on water and rain and growth and bread. We count on your regularities, but then we look for peace and find no good. For a time of healing, but there is terror instead. We do not expect failed rain or failed bread or failed peace or failed healing. The failure lies deep in the fabric of our common life. We turn away from that self-destructiveness, back to you, you, Creator, beginning and end, first and last. You, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter. You, whose patience we try. You, whose sovereign will for good overrides our capacity for self-destruction. Look to this world of need. Restore, recreate, enliven, give rain, give food, give peace. For there is no other source, none except you, in your sovereign reliability.